Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode here at the Damage Report. Today is Tuesday, and you never know what you're gonna get, but what you're gonna get is pretty awesome. We're joined once again by Yasmin Aliyah Khan. Yasmin, welcome back to the show.
Hi, John. Thank you so much for having me. It's always exciting to be on the Damage Report. Really excited to dive into some of these topics.
And we're excited to have you dive in along with us. You're the host of Global Threads podcast. Tell people a little bit about what you do.
Podcast and a lot of my work is focused on raising awareness for different issues that are going on around the globe, as opposed to just here in the United States, things that might get some coverage in our news cycles, but really don't go into a whole lot. And that's what my podcast is all about, looking into the context, the history, how we got here, how it does involve the US, if it does at all, and usually it does, and seeing if and what the way forward is from that point.
That's awesome. And it's important. America is a really insular country. We're trained to only care about our own history and what's going on here. Most people don't pay attention to international news. And so it's good that you're trying to get them to.
Thank you.
We try occasionally too on TDR, and it's fun. We cover news occasionally from around the globe and then release it, and nobody watches it. So that's always fun, but we're not going to stop. We've been doing it for years. We're going to keep doing it. Give us a couple thousand views, whatever. We're still going to do it anyway. Yeah, it's just the Iranian election. No need to watch it or anything anyway. But we're very glad to have you here, everyone. Thank you for being here, regardless of what platform you're watching on. Maybe you're on the app, maybe you're on Twitch, maybe YouTube. I don't know. Maybe you're on a platform I don't even know about. There's probably a lot of those. Am I live streaming on Instagram? Probably. Am I doing a short? I don't know. But anyway, wherever you are, there's probably some way that you can like it, share it, favorite, bop it, boop it. I don't know. If you could do that, that would be helpful because the algorithm rules all. And along the way, we are going to be talking for the next roughly 85 minutes or so about voting rights, the filibuster. Kyrsten Sinema has a new defense of herself. Is it worth a damn? Yasmin and I will evaluate that. Lindsey Graham spreading nonsense. Trump pissed off about nonsense. So there's going to be a lot of things that we're going to be talking about. If you have any thoughts about it, questions, anything like that, you can send in messages and we will respond to those during our little social break. So that should be fun. Oh, by the way, before we launch into our news, and along the way, I'll be giving you some behind the scenes information, programming, stuff like that. The Ohio event that's coming up, the Economic Justice Town Hall that we told you about, it is very much not happening in Cincinnati. It is in Cleveland. Apologies for that if anyone was confused. Thankfully, it says on the graphic Cleveland, which is probably enough for you to know where it is. Not enough for me to get it right. But anyway, that's going to be Cenk Uygur and Killer Mike. They're going to be doing this along with Senator Nina Turner, talking about living wage, Medicare for all, a number of different issues. So that is coming up. Go to tyt.com/events to get accurate information about it. Keep watching this show to get sporadically inaccurate information about it. And with that, Yasmin, are you ready to jump into some news?
Always.
Okay, let's do it. Senate Democrats have put forward their voting rights bill. And hey, you know, it's not so bad. It would, by the way, it's already passed the House. If it were to be passed, it would set up public financing of federal elections, establish minimum standards for early and absentee polling times, same day registration, put nonpartisan panels in charge of redrawing congressional districts, thus effectively getting rid of gerrymandering. It also sets ethics requirements for the president and vice president, changes the composition of the Federal Elections Commission, which is the federal agency that oversees campaign spending. There'd be more disclosure on dark money. There would be a national voting holiday, and all of that is great, but it's probably not going to happen because it's the Senate. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer needs support from 60 senators to bring the bill up for discussion, which is just really fast. We're going to come back to this graphic in 1 second. That's just the way it's said now. It's not. This is something that's overwhelmingly supported by the American people, but the Republicans are filibustering it. It's just you need 60 votes, I guess. Anyway, he isn't going to get that because right now, even with the VP, they would just narrowly break ties. It's not even clear at this point if Chuck Schumer could get all of the Democrats to support this bill, because as of right now, Joe Manchin doesn't support it without revisions, which we've been talking about on the show. We might return to. So as of right now, it is definitely going to be filibustered, whether they identify it as that or not. And even if it were, it's not clear that it would pass. So Yasmin, we finally got this in response to all of what's going on in all these states around the country to stop voting. And it's not looking like much is going to happen, at least immediately.
You know, whenever I think of filibusters, I always think of that episode of Parks and Rec with Patton Oswalt, and he did like this whole, he improvised the whole thing actually, and it was like this whole Star Wars filibuster that he did. And it is that ridiculous. I mean, the other common example that comes to mind is Ted Cruz reading Green Eggs and Ham, My Own Senator. You all know how much I love him. I'm sure you all love him just as much as I do. But the filibuster itself, I think what's is important to understand about this particular issue with Sinema and Manchin and what's going on in the Senate, and the idea that you need a 60 majority as opposed to just like 51, right, which would still technically be a majority, is that I think it creates kind of a false perspective amongst the American people that this is an issue that the American people are also divided on. That's not the case, right? So we have an instance where the Senate is not being reflective of what the American people want. And even in Kyrsten Sinema's case, her approval ratings have gone down since she's done all of this. The people of Arizona have said, no, we do want this to happen and you're stopping it from happening. So she's actively not representing her constituents and she knows it. And this whole debate, I think, glosses over the fact that the majority of Americans, including Arizona residents, they do want this to pass. They do want to get rid of the filibuster. And it is a ridiculous thing that we all still just keep doing.
Yeah. Yeah, and as you point out, like there are those depictions of it in popular culture. By the way, someone had told me about that Patton Oswalt one a while back. I have actually watched it. It's pretty amazing that he ad-libbed it. But so here's the thing. It is generally pretty ridiculous. Now, there have been, I think, some fairly epic filibusters years ago. There was one in Texas. The thing is, like, no, we're not gonna have that. So Ted Cruz is not going to be reading from Green Eggs and Ham to stop you from being able to vote. He's not gonna have to because the Democrats aren't gonna require him to. And look, it might be that forcing them to actually filibuster, if they're gonna filibuster, in this case, wouldn't matter. Maybe they would just do it for 6 weeks or whatever and be happy to grind like everything to a halt. But isn't it a little bit weird that there doesn't appear to have been any discussion, certainly not publicly, about maybe making them do that for any of these bills? Chuck Schumer is not saying, oh, by the way, Mitch McConnell, you might have to hold the floor. And if you guys ever stop talking, we're gonna pass this thing. It isn't even a consideration. It's just, oh, you don't approve of this? Oh, I guess we're moving on. Isn't that weird, Yasmin? Like, shouldn't we at least make them pull a Patton Oswalt if they care so much about stopping people from being able to vote?
You know what's weird about all this for me is that one of my pet peeves personally is anything that is more difficult or takes longer than I feel like it should, or more difficult than it should be. And that's what all this is. But you're right, like there does have to be some kind of accountability. If you're gonna, you know, work by these rules, then work with the rules, work within the parameters that you have. And even that we're not really seeing a whole lot of. It seems like once they filibuster or once they decide to kill a bill, however they do it, that's it. That's the last you ever hear of it. So if the Senate doesn't pass this bill, what's gonna happen to it? I'm not optimistic that it will come back around for reconsideration or that it will even be renegotiated. And if it does, how long until that happens? And then in the meantime, you have a lot of these red states, including Texas, which is where I am, who are actively passing these very restrictive voting bills while all this is happening. So we're losing time.
Yeah, well, certainly. I mean, if Manchin's got his compromise or whatever, which has some absolute garbage in it, but also has a lot of good stuff. How long is that gonna take? And by the way, they're not gonna get enough Republicans on board for that either. And so again, this is just a conversation about the filibuster. And so can they get enough Democrats to change on that? That's what we will turn to now. There is an increasing amount of public pressure on some of the holdouts on reforming the filibuster to change their position in response to the fact that the Republicans are just gonna filibuster literally everything. Now, the way that reform would work, it depends. Some people are pushing for complete elimination of the filibuster. Some are saying, hey, make them actually filibuster. Some are saying 60 votes as the thing that's needed to invoke cloture that's not some sort of concrete thing that was handed down by God. It's been higher before, it could be lower in the future. So these are things that are happening. And right now there are dozens of different liberal groups that are preparing a last ditch effort to pressure senators and keep the issue alive through television ads, phone banks, and rallies nationwide over the 4th of July holiday. Some are lining up to target Democratic lawmakers like Dianne Feinstein. So Feinstein has previously opposed changing Senate rules to eliminate the 60 vote threshold, but has also signaled that she might consider it over voting rights. That said, how much faith do you have that she's even gonna remember that that's a thing that she said? Because we've been through this before this year, where she has signaled interest in some reforms and then later said she's never said that, and said nobody's talked about reform. Like, it's literally not even a thing that's been going on. So I hope that she is just lying outrageously to us, because the alternatives are not as good. That said, some of the bigger holdouts who haven't even really indicated any interest, like Joe Manchin had said maybe making it a talking filibuster, but then he backtracked even on that, they're gonna require a little bit more effort. And there are ad campaigns targeting them. However, as of right now, senators like Kyrsten Sinema are holding strong to their utter hypocrisy. And so Kyrsten Sinema put out this op-ed, and we wanna give you a little bit of her defense of the filibuster. She says, "Everyday Arizonans are focused on questions that matter most in their daily lives. Is my job secure? Can I expand my business? Can we afford college? What about healthcare? When can I retire? Is my community safe? Meanwhile, much of Washington's focus is on a Senate rule requiring 60 votes to advance most legislation." Now, I'm gonna let you in just one sec, Yasmin, but really fast, I just need to respond to that. So first of all, you voted down raising the minimum wage. Meh, we're not gonna forget that. Oh, is that what they're really worried about? Well, it seems like you effed them over. Okay, because that wasn't the filibuster, that was just you stopping them from getting more wages. And by the way, they're worried about the things that really matter in their daily lives, not the filibuster. The filibuster is just the thing that the Republicans are gonna use to stop progress on literally every one of the things that she just listed. So can we afford college? Oh, I don't know, maybe the Democrats could pass some sort of bill to make it more affordable. Oh, that would just be filibustered? Oh, okay. What about healthcare? Hey, maybe we can make healthcare better. We can lower the age for Medicare, or maybe do something to make prescriptions a little bit more affordable. Oh, that would just be filibustered. Okay, what else do they care about? Retirement, their community safety, is their job security. These are all things that would be filibustered, but she's going to, that's just the beginning of her op-ed. She is 100% gaslighting on the actual stakes in this conversation. This is not some arcane debate about political philosophy. This is about whether the Senate will ever function literally at all. And she's not interested in it doing that. Now, we're gonna have more of what she said, but Yasmin, what do you think so far about Kyrsten Sinema?
I like that you use the G word, gaslighting, because that's exactly what this reminded me of, especially with Feinstein. And you know, I feel like this country, for the last 4 years when we had Trump as our president, we've been dealing with that kind of gaslighting abuse for so long, and all of us are kind of shell-shocked from it, you know? So whenever you have somebody like Feinstein saying one thing and they're just like, oh, I don't know, she'll probably just take it away, you know, the next time she opens her mouth, that's a real concern for a lot of people. And on the other hand, you have Sinema, who's saying, here's what my constituents actually care about. But then she also said that I listen to business owners and I do whatever they want me to do. So she, you know, admitted what we all suspected, that she is selling out basically. But on top of that, yeah, of course people are talking about those issues and they're not talking about filibustering, because you're the one in Congress, you're the one who understands these processes, and you're the one who's supposed to be making them more efficient and shedding light on these things. Of course the Americans are talking about their wages and not filibustering. That's your job. And it's, you know, people like you, John, it's your job to raise that awareness for people so that we can have more insight, I guess, into the inner workings of Washington. And I think that that's one of the biggest problems, is that a lot of people don't really understand the way the government functions on a day-to-day basis. And we're all just trying to figure it out. And we have things like the filibuster that go back in our history, not just in our history, but in other nations and other empires and things like that too. And none of this is new. Filibustering does not foster bipartisanship. It never has, right? Even if the intention is or ever was that, functionally that hasn't been what happens. So yeah, it's trash.
I agree. And she's gonna cite a few ways that she think it would lead to bipartisanship, and will respond and demonstrate the point that Yasmin is making right there. So overall she says, and I think this is pretty revealing, it's no secret that I oppose eliminating the Senate 60 vote threshold. I held the same view during 3 terms in the US House and said the same after I was elected to the Senate in 2018. If anyone expected me to reverse my position because my party now controls the Senate, They should know that my approach to legislating in Congress is the same, whether in the minority or majority. And I think that's totally true, but not for any of the reasons she would openly admit. I think whether in the minority or the majority, she doesn't really give a damn about getting much done because the business interests are doing just fine. They were doing fine with the Republicans. They got tax breaks and that sort of stuff. Now she's helping to stop those taxes from being increased. So yeah, they're doing okay. Now in terms of whether we expected her to reverse her position because my party now controls the Senate, no, that isn't why I expect you to change your position. I expect you to change your position because the filibuster has been 100% abused. And it is nothing like the historic use of it, which was messed up in a million of its own ways. But now the expected filibuster on literally every piece of legislation, the existence of the filibuster, by the way, not leading to bipartisanship. You cannot get Republicans on board with these bills, making a mockery of your philosophical defensive at the fact that as long as it's here, we have a reason to compromise. No, we clearly don't, because you're not compromising. It's just nonsense. Now, she goes on to say, to give some of those examples, to those who want to eliminate the legislative filibuster to pass the For the People Act, voting rights legislation I support and have co-sponsored, support in only the most shallow way, since she's ensuring that it will never pass. I would ask, would it be good for our country if we did, only to see that legislation rescinded a few years from now and replaced by a nationwide voter ID law or restrictions on voting by mail in federal elections over the objections of the minority? They're already doing all of those things, perhaps not nationwide. After all, they're not in control of the federal government, but they're doing that in tons of states. That's why the For the People Act is so necessary. She's saying, why get a bill and then lose it? And then we'll pass it and then we'll lose it. So instead, we'll just let them do everything they want, and we will lay down like possums, like we're Ted Cruz himself. We're just gonna let them do it and we'll never fight back, not even temporarily. There won't be any ups and downs. It's just straight down for the rest of American history. How is that an argument for the filibuster at this point? But the reason that she can say stuff like that is that she shares something very special in common with Joe Manchin, which is she's doing fine and she's not worried about what's happening. She's gonna be fine either way. She's wealthy, she's got a secure position, she's gonna be protected by the Democratic Party. So why worry? Why change anything? But for us, we can't just look rosily at the elimination of voting rights in more and more states, because that actually hurts us in some way, even if it doesn't affect her negatively. Sorry, Yasmin, thoughts?
I think it's important to understand that all of it is kind of connected. And I always say this, the only thing that I ever really agreed with Trump on was that we need term limits for senators and for Congress people, because I think a lot of this would be eliminated with something like that. You know, they're worried about getting reelected, kind of. You know, her constituents don't really support her, but she has all these business interests behind her. And on top of that, if Arizona decides to restrict voting and voting access and things like that, then maybe that would work out well for her in the end. I don't know. But it all is connected, right? And also the whole argument of like flip-flopping America, how is that any different from what's already been happening? You know, we saw Trump undo everything Obama did. Now we see Biden trying to undo everything that Trump did. So it's not an excuse.
Yeah, it certainly shouldn't be. She closes, and I'll have one more point. She says, instability, partisanship, and tribalism continue to infect our politics, which she can identify, but doesn't actually recognize or care about the consequences of that. The solution, however, is not to continue weakening our democracy's guardrails. If we eliminate the Senate 60 vote threshold, we will lose much more than we gain. That is not what is going to weaken our democracy's guardrails. They are being shredded right now, and she is just sitting and watching it happen and talking about philosophy and stuff like that. You can read her a full thing, it's available on a bunch of websites. The big point that she makes is, sure, right now it might be nice to not have the filibuster, but at some point we'll wish that we did. We'll be back in the minority, and won't you wish then that we had the filibuster? I would say, first of all, as a counter to that, you are guaranteeing that that situation is going to happen, because you are acting like a loser, you're governing like a loser, so you're gonna lose, and we're gonna lose the Senate. So that's gonna happen. The other point is, she cites specific examples. So if they try to mess with Medicare or Medicaid or Social Security, if they try to pass some sort of bill that harms aid to women or to children, won't you wish that you had the filibuster? And that is absolute nonsensical misinformation and BS. Because every one of the examples she gives are things that the Republicans can 100% eliminate through budget reconciliation. They are not things that the filibuster will actually be able to protect against. I got news for you. Nothing the Republicans seriously want to do can be stopped with the filibuster. In theory, there's some culture war stuff they could maybe do, but they don't actually seem to really care about that when they're in office. They talk about it a ton, but they don't actually try to do those things. What they do is stuff messing with the economy, tax cuts, stuff like that, stuff that the filibuster can't protect against because they'll just do it via reconciliation, and judges. They want to get hard right judges, and the filibuster can't protect against that either. Again, I will say this a million times. This is not an even playing field. This is asymmetric warfare. The Republicans have like three things they want to do. Every time they get in power, they do them, and the filibuster will never protect you against them. The Democrats, in theory, get elected to do far more things, and the filibuster will always stop them from doing those things. That is a guarantee. That is politics with this status quo for the rest of your life, at least as long as people like Kyrsten Sinema are in charge. Anyway. Any closing thoughts, Yasmin, on this about the filibuster? Do you think that a voting bill is going to pass? Any like the compromise, the Manchin compromise, anything?
At this point, I have no idea whether or not it will pass. The Manchin compromise, maybe, you know, I think he thinks that he can work something out. Maybe it's ego, I don't know. But at the end of the day, I'm just tired of dealing with people's own issues as a national issue. You know, if Joe Manchin has a huge ego, or if Kyrsten Sinema is a sellout, why is that my problem? Like, just like deal with your own stuff so I don't have to. So the rest of this country doesn't have to. That's how I feel about that.
That would be nice. No, and Yasmin's totally right. He says he's gonna be able to get a deal. He said that on the January 6th commission. There's gonna be 10 good Republicans. Yep. Where are they? I don't see 10 good Republicans. I don't see any of them. So I'm sure that'll work out. But anyway, I will turn the question I threw to Yasmin to you. We have a poll up right now, tyt.com/polls/voting-rights-bill. The Democrats for the People Act strengthening voting rights is expected to come up for a vote this afternoon. Republicans are planning to block it. Despite this, there's gonna be pressure. Will they eventually succeed? And we are giving you the lowest bar ever. Will any voting rights bill pass in the Senate? Yes or no? You can go to tyt.com/polls to participate in that, and we will give you the results a little bit later on. Okay, we are gonna take a short break, see what's going on out there in the audience, and then we'll be back with a lot more news for you. Okay, everybody, let's jump into some more topics. One big part of the For the People Act would be to fundamentally change gerrymandering, effectively rendering it impossible to do stereotypical traditional partisan gerrymandering. That, I think, is a good thing. Is that just common sense? It's a good thing to not have one party choosing its own seats rather than having the people choose their representatives. That said, if you're an elected politician and it's benefited you and your party in the past, kind of scary to get rid of gerrymandering. So why not just lie about it? And we have some of that. Lindsey Graham, technically still a senator, had this to say. There's a provision in the For the People Act that would take away from states the ability to draw congressional lines and give it to an independent commission created in Washington. That means that when people move to South Carolina, Florida, and Texas, and we get new congressmen and women, because people are moving and the population shifts, that Republican state houses can't draw those lines, but some Democratic appointed commission. That would be the end of redistricting as we know it. So he is right in that last sentence. It would be the end of redistricting as we know it. But Yasmin, would you be shocked to find out that everything else he said was absolute hogwash? But anyway, we'll get to the fact check in a little bit. What do you think about, like, fundamentally things like reforming gerrymandering, reforming campaign finance, stuff like that? Seems like it's always going to receive a great deal of pushback from the people who have risen to power with the system the way it is.
Of course, yeah. I mean, why wouldn't they? What incentive would they have to reform these things? And this kind of goes back to my earlier point that I was making, that it creates this false narrative that the people are split 50-50, and they're not, right? In Texas, we're seeing a lot of that right now. I'm sure you guys, you guys have covered this on your show, right? About all the voting violations that are happening in Texas. And a lot of it is as a result of what happened back in November 2020 and during that election, things with, you know, the mail-in voting was attacked and things like that. And in Texas right now, we're seeing an influx of people come in from California. The jury is still out on what kind of Californians are coming. We have an idea, but we'll see. But a lot of you know, at least speaking for Texas, a lot of the idea of what Texans are is misconstrued in the media, at least from my own personal experience of living in this state for 20 years, because there's this idea that, you know, Texas is on the verge of flipping blue and we're actually a purple state and all these things. But you would never know that if you looked at the districts and if you looked at the maps. My own district is very heavily gerrymandered, and it's a problem because my vote really doesn't count for much in a federal election. And it needs to stop, but the people who are benefiting from it are the ones who can stop it, and why would they? So this has been a problem for a long time in a lot of states, some worse than others, and it hasn't gone away, and there's a reason for that.
You're right, you're right. And look, and by the way, Texas is a great example of how gerrymandering can, like, generally we talk about it as benefiting Republicans and Republicans being the one to do it. Now, of course, there have been cases where Democratic state legislatures have gerrymandered to their own benefit. That's certainly true. And in some cases, even when it's Republicans, it benefits certain Democrats. So, like, there are districts in Texas that are overwhelmingly Democratic. And that benefits those Democrats because they're never gonna lose as long as they can get past the primary. But it's not that heavily Democratic because it makes sense geographically. The Republicans of the state legislature have put as many Democrats into one place as possible rather than having Democrats potentially competing in and winning multiple districts. So those Democrats theoretically might be opposed to it too. So it's always gonna be difficult. That said, if we're gonna have a debate about gerrymandering, maybe we could just have an honest debate about what's actually being proposed. And what Lindsey Graham is saying is not true at all. Daniel Dale of CNN did a fact check. He says the bill would, well, actually he's quoting experts who've analyzed the law, to be fair, but Daniel Dale seems largely trustworthy in his fact checks. The bill would require congressional redistricting by independent commission, but independent commissions to be established under state law by the states themselves, not created in Washington. The commissions would not be Democratic appointed, but instead members would be selected through a nonpartisan process with membership composed of equal numbers of Democrats, Republicans, and independents. The bill would ban partisan gerrymandering, the practice of drawing district boundaries in order to benefit a particular party. The bill would also require much more transparency in the redistricting process than many states currently provide. And the bill would take boundary drawing power out of the hands of state politicians and give it to independent commissions made up of state residents. In response to that fact check, Graham's office did not respond to CNN's request for comment. So no, it is not a federal commission that chooses it. The federal law just says your states need to establish nonpartisan bodies. And by the way, some states which already have that would be allowed to just continue with those same commissions. They wouldn't have to set up new ones. And it is, it's not to say that there couldn't be things that go wrong, but it is like shockingly trying to be fair. Like in states, you get 5 Democrats, 5 Republicans, and 5 nonpartisan people. Now, I personally say, what the hell is a nonpartisan adult? What adult doesn't have preferences? But they're really seeming like they're gonna try. And it's not like this is new. Multiple states have already been doing it. And state residents get to get appointed to look at the proposed districts. If they don't like them, they can vote them down, and then the courts will get involved to help adjudicate the districts. There are so many different layers of trying to make this fair. And worst case scenario, one party might end up having more influence than we want over the process, which I will remind you is the situation right now. So I don't know, like I don't think that Graham particularly cares about the accuracy of his comments, but I do think that if people knew what this process actually was, Yasmin, I think that they would largely like it, especially in response to the complete and utter baked in unfairness of the system as it is.
My biggest grievance was your point that you had made earlier about how, you know, the nonpartisan adults. First of all, who are these people? I've never met them. I've never met a nonpartisan adult who actually still cared about politics at all, right? Mm-hmm. If you care about anything, you tend to have an opinion that favors one way or the other. Not always, but usually. It kind of reminds me of like the jury selection process, how they try to get an idea of who you are as a human and what your views are before, you know, by asking you a few simple ideas or questions and see how you answer. But I think the idea of states dictating these rules and these laws and regulations and things like that is terrifying for me in Texas. And I think enough said there, because our entire state legislation is very, very red, very Republican, and like Trump Republican, not whatever moderate Republicans even are these days. So yeah, that is terrifying for me. At the end of the day, something needs to get done. I don't know when it will happen or if it will even happen, but it is a fight that needs to keep happening, that needs to be fought. I want to give a shout out to my best friend from like 20 years ago, because she was the one who actually introduced me to gerrymandering a long time ago. This was in like junior high. Mm-hmm. She was reading the paper, the Houston Chronicle, and she's going on about gerrymandering, and nobody knew what she was talking about. And then, you know, here we are today. So shout out to Sarah.
Thank you, Sarah. You're doing the Lord's work. Anyway, okay. Yeah, there are more details. Look it up. It's a pretty interesting system. But anyway, we're gonna move on to our next topic, which is insane. It's utter nonsense. But hey, it's America, so that's what we got. Let's do this. Back in March of 2019, Donald Trump was doing something that he swears he never does, would never do. He was watching Saturday Night Live. And apparently he's so committed to watching SNL despite his claims not to. He was watching reruns. It wasn't even a new one. It wasn't even like, hey, like a new, like, ooh, Scarlett Johansson's back on for upcoming movie. I gotta see that. He was watching a rerun and they made fun of him because it is a satirical show that does political satire. And in response, he tweeted, "It's truly incredible that shows like Saturday Night Live, not funny, no talent, can spend all their time knocking the same person, me, over and over without so much of a mention of the other side, like an advertisement without consequences. Same with late night shows, which I also don't watch every single night." So he had a big issue with this. And so he tweeted more saying, "Should Federal Election Commission and or FCC look into this? There must be collusion with the Democrats and of course Russia. I think Cecily Strong is meeting with Bill Clinton. I'm fairly certain of it." Okay, he didn't actually say that. Such one-sided media coverage, most of it fake news. Hard to believe I won and am winning. Approval rating 52%, 93% with Republicans. And I guarantee that was Rasmussen that gave him the 52%. But anyway, so he had an issue with it. Now, this is not the first time that he's complained about people criticizing him. I get it. Nobody likes to be made fun of. Generally, if you don't like to be mocked, though, don't be so utterly ridiculous in everything you do. But that's not the issue. Having a problem with satire and thinking that like Kate McKinnon is like conspiring with Barack Obama, that's weird, but that's not the issue. The issue is when he tries to deploy the power of the state against a comedy show, which he apparently did. According to two different people familiar with the matter, Trump had asked lawyers and advisors in early 2019 about what the FCC, the court systems, and the Department of Justice could do to probe or mitigate SNL, Jimmy Kimmel, and other late night comedy mischief makers. One of the sources says, "It was more annoying than alarming, to be honest with you," which I sort of get. In early 2019, he had to be repeatedly advised that the equal time rules to which he appeared to refer in tweets like what we showed you wouldn't even apply in this situation, given that late night shows and NBC sketch comedy are clearly staged satire and are thus not bound by the same requirements of other forms of broadcast TV and radio. So it's not like it's not the nightly news. They're doing jokes. That's what they do. They go on and they tell jokes. But he was really, really bothered by this, Yasmin.
Well, of course he was. It would be very anti-Donald Trump if he was not bothered by it. And this really is the epitome of somebody who is just used to getting what he wants all the time. And his own knowledge gaps are not even a concern for him, whether or not he's actually aware of the knowledge gaps that he has. So something that's so obvious to people like you and me, and I would imagine a lot of Americans, that you know, SNL doesn't count. It's not free advertisement for Obama or Joe Biden or Bernie Sanders or whoever. You know, I mean, he was a host on that show. They gave him all that airtime. You know,
yeah,
they came under a lot of flack for that too. Yeah, why did any of that have to happen? But then. It's just ridiculous, and it's a waste of everybody's time. It's a waste of money, usually, because a lot of times there's money involved in these things. And just because, again, somebody's ego is hurt, we got to spend all this money, we got to waste all this time, we got to waste all this energy on it. And it really is just a really simple solution. And instead, now we got to talk about it, you know?
Yeah.
Now it's a thing that threatens our country sometimes, not in this particular case.
Thankfully, Look, this is another example of just yesterday we found out about his desire to send like tourists that had COVID to Guantanamo Bay. Yeah. Well, this is another thing where Trump's first instinct is horrific. Like it's like villain in a movie horrific. But thankfully, there were aides that stopped him. Now, bear in mind, whenever a leak like this happens, the aides probably play up how instrumental they were. I think that, like for instance, let me give you this last graphic. Can something else be done about it? Trump replied when they said that the FCC and the DOJ don't punish comedians. They responded, "I'll look into it." This person says that to this day, they have not in fact looked into it. Look, yes, they did help to distract him, but he's also eminently distractible. Like the dude is gonna move on to something else insane right after. So, but that really saved us in a lot of cases. Like some aides that try to like squirrel him away from his worst excesses and the fact that he can't hold a thought in his mind for more than two or three contiguous seconds. So that definitely helped us. And that is why SNL didn't get destroyed by the DOJ. And they didn't send people to Guantanamo Bay, and he didn't nuke the hurricanes, and he didn't put crocodiles in a moat to stop migrants from crossing the border. But these are all things that to him seemed like good ideas at the time, Yasmin.
Yeah, about even the border wall with Mexico, that was just something that came to him in a rally one day. And now we've spent how much money on this border wall with Mexico after he said that Mexico was gonna pay for it. And even that wasn't true. It was a huge misrepresentation of who was actually going to be paying for these things. And at the end of the day, all these distractions are ridiculous and they are comical, but they are distractions and they take away from things that are actually important. And I think that's the biggest problem. I think that was one of the things that frustrated me the most with the Donald Trump presidency, is that every day it was like something else that we all had to deal with collectively as a nation, when in the meantime, people are struggling and just waiting for help to come their way, and it's not coming because now we got to talk about COFEFE, whatever, you know what I mean? It's all so ridiculous. And I think that was probably the point of a lot of it, was to distract people. That isn't lost on a lot of people, hopefully, that you know Trump will say something, or used to before he was silenced or whatever. But he would say things and get all these headlines, capture all these you know pundits and you know the collective attention of the American people. And in the meantime, he's doing some other really vile things behind the scenes, him or the Republicans or the people who work on behalf of him. And that's the bigger problem, I think.
Yeah. The last thing I'll say about this is SNL makes fun of people. That's what they do. Like just get over it or whatever. And by the way, like you might think, oh, that's easy for you to say. They agree with you politically. Not necessarily. Like, have you watched SNL? They don't seem to love Bernie Sanders. They're impersonations of AOC. Like I like Melissa Villaseñor. I don't think it's a particularly positive portrayal of her. A lot of what they say is like centrist with like a little bit of progressive values kind of layered on top a little bit. And they certainly don't like Trump. And they certainly don't like Republicans. That is definitely true. But that does not mean that they are like hard left by any means. Not that I need to convince people that. I think most people pretty much get that. Anyway, with that, we are going to take our second break. And when we come back, we've got a little bit of good news, I think. And then Texas has some issues. We're gonna give Yasmin a chance to respond to that after this. Okay, Yasmin, how about a heartwarming story? How about something that seems almost like good news? How about that?
I don't trust that at all, but I'm ready.
No. I got sarcastic, didn't I? I don't even know how to be optimistic anymore. It just comes off as like kind of creepy.
I know, I'm like scared. I'm nervous.
No. This is good. Okay, we're gonna jump into it right now. Okay. Just in time for Pride Month, we've got some good news. The first active NFL player comes out as gay in a video, and we're gonna talk about it. Here's a bit of that video though. This is Carl Nassib.
What's up, people? I'm Carl Nassib. I'm at my house here in Westchester, Pennsylvania. Just want to take a quick moment to say that I'm gay. I've been meaning to do this for a while now, but I finally feel comfortable enough to get it off my chest. I really have the best life. I got the best family, friends, and job a guy could ask for. I'm a pretty private person, so I hope you guys know that I'm really not doing this for attention. I just think that representation and visibility are so important. I actually hope that like one day videos like this and the whole coming out process are just not necessary. But until then, you know, I'm going to do my best and do my part to cultivate a culture that's accepting, that's compassionate. And I'm going to start by donating $100,000 to the Trevor Project. They're an incredible organization. They're the number one suicide prevention service for LGBTQ youth in America. And they're truly doing incredible things. And I'm very excited to be a part of it, to help in any way that I can. And I'm really pumped to see what the future holds.
That was awesome. Carl Nassib, now my favorite football player. And I know what you're thinking, John, you don't watch football. There's no competition. That, sure. But now by far my favorite football. That was a great, I think the fact that he's going to be donating $100,000 to the Trevor Project, which is awesome too. You know, like the explanation of why he's doing it, a desire for it to someday not be a thing that's considered necessary. Like the explanation of his value system, that was awesome. Yeah, in so many different ways, even more so than I expected.
Yeah, it was a really good video. I like how he said it too. He's like, yeah, I just want to let you guys know that I'm gay. So straight, simple, and so to the point. And whenever something like this happens, you kind of tend to see two different narratives forming within supportive communities, right? And one, well, he actually touched on it, I think. One of them is that, you know, why is this necessary? It's 2021. Why do we have to keep talking about being gay like it's a thing, like it's a big deal? But the other side of it is that visibility does matter, especially in pockets within the country, such as the NFL, right? So you have, I was reading some comments on like Instagram the other day, and somebody was saying something like, come on, it's 2021. How are you not vegan yet, right? And I think what can happen is that we get into these really insular bubbles and we think that the rest of the country and the rest of the world is on board, but we forget that there's so many places in this one country that are not there, that these are conversations that never come up for people. So the more it is out there, the more normalized it can be, it's still gonna be a process, right? We've come a long way, but we still have a very, very long way to go. And people coming out in spaces like the NFL and talking about it and donating to causes, all that matters, and it is important. And it is a very heartwarming story, and I'm sorry for doubting you.
Thank you. Yeah, I agree. And to do it, like, I guess there's a certain, like, I don't know, is bravery the right word in how casual it is? Like, yeah, you know, I'm doing it. I'm telling you this because it is historic. There has never been an active football player who has come out before. There was Michael Sam back like 7 years ago, drafted, but didn't actually play. And there have been players who have come out after they had retired, but just very casually he's doing it. This is second year with the Raiders. I'm just finding out, sixth in the league. I just learned right now, but that's awesome. I wanted to give you a little bit more from Carl about the donation. Says, for someone like me who's been so lucky and cherishes every day, it brings me incredible sadness to think that our LGBTQ youth are at such an elevated risk of suicide. I feel an immense pressure to help in any way I can, which is awesome. And in particular, like, you know, we're gonna be talking about Texas. Like, Texas is one of many states that's decided, you know, demonizing trans youth is like the way to get our base all fired up. So contributing to more depression and potentially more suicide in the future. So certainly a community that's gonna need support. It's great to see awesome role models like this. Now, really fast, I wanted to give you a quote from Warren Moon. Obviously, even I familiar with Warren Moon, a former football player, says, really proud of Carl Nassib, the first active football player to ever do so. I played with several guys who never were comfortable enough to go public. They were great teammates and obviously very talented. And yeah, there's just this idea that like teams have known obviously for a very long time, some players, but there was stigma, there was potentially strike back. Like, look at what happened to Michael Sam, like a lot of the news coverage around that and what a bunch of conservatives were saying. So yeah, I'm glad to see it. That said, Yasmin, one less optimistic component of this is even now, even in 2021, the way that some people communicate about this is just so regrettable. So the New York Times had a headline, Carl Nassib was an NFL everyman, then he came out as gay. And I get what they think they're trying to do. They're trying to be like, but no, so much baked into that of like, no, he still is. That he is an everyman, because some everyman are like that. Not every man is like that, but some everyman are like that. And so I don't know who came up with that headline. It almost certainly wasn't the person that wrote the author, so please don't abuse them online. But just, oh God. Sometimes I don't know. Any other thoughts about this?
I think whenever you get op-eds or even, you know, articles from reporters that have headlines like that, they're a little nebulous or a little contrarian. It's like, are you just trying to make a name for yourself by putting this out there? Sometimes they take such weird takes on things, and it's like, is this your own career advancement? Is this a belief that you have? Because it feels like they go out of their way to misrepresent an issue or a topic, or to come up with something really unique that hasn't already been said. And there's a lot of things that, you know, sometimes even me, I don't comment on, because I don't think that I can add any more to a conversation that has already been said. So I get that angle, but it's like, well, then just don't say anything. You don't need to create a controversy where there isn't one, or where there shouldn't be one.
Yeah. Yeah. And especially when you know that there is going to be insane attacks against him. Like, I don't know. And honestly, for my own well-being, I'm not looking to see what right-wing sites are saying about Carl, but I imagine it's not going to be great. And so don't contribute to that. Don't be a part of that. Like, yeah. And for me, like, you don't need to expose yourself to this. Like, honestly, this would be my advice to Trump from the last story. Don't watch SNL, buddy. If you can't take the jokes, don't watch it. It's going to make you feel bad. Come on, everybody has to maintain their own, like, whatever exposure to the criticism you can take. So anyway, yeah, great job by Carl, an awesome way to do it. The donation is awesome, hopefully inspiring other people to feel comfortable too, but almost certainly will be attacked as a result of it. Now, that said, we only have like another minute and a half, which is definitely not time to give our Texas story the due that it deserves. So we will be taking a break in just a minute, and we'll come back and do that Texas story. So I'm gonna take this opportunity to read a few of your comments. Oh, actually, what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna remind you. You don't need to be reminded. You know what happens after our show, right? Indisputably, what happens is indisputable. Dr. Rashad Ritchie's show, Adrian Lawrence is gonna be the co-host today. Pastor Jesse Lee Peterson, who I believe I remember some of the crazy things Jesse Lee Peterson has said. This is a conservative host who Dr. Rashad Ritchie is going to be debating. So that's going to be something. You're not going to want to miss that. And BC Silver is going to be the guest as well. So all of that is coming up at 11:30 p.m. Pacific time, 2:30 p.m. Eastern time. Yeah, sorry. So that's coming up at Indisputable TYT on YouTube. So definitely check that out. As well, I want to give you another reminder. In Ohio, the Economic Justice Town Hall, everyone should go to tyt.com/events, and you can sign up for news updates about that event, which is going to feature Cenk Uygur, Killer Mike, and Nina Turner. That's coming up in Cleveland, June 26th. But there are going to be other events as well. Now that the world is reopening, nature is healing. So go to tyt.com/events. You can sign up for notifications about events that might be coming to an area near you. Now, really fast, the few seconds I have. Quaker Lady in the super chat said, ever since Senator John Kyle blatantly excused his PP lies as not intended to be factual, I never trust any poll. Yes, we shouldn't have before that, but hey, we all learn. And there's unfortunately not time. So to our linear audience, thank you for watching. For those of you on the members app, Twitch and YouTube, thank you so much. We've got a lot more coming up after this break. See you in a few. Welcome back, everyone, to the last third of the Damage Report with me, Johnny Roll. If you're just joining, Yasmin Aliyah Khan joins us. Yasmin, it is always great to have you here.
Always happy to be here.
And where you are is Texas, which we're going to turn to right now.
Oh, yeah.
Texas is one of many US states in the middle of a devastating heat wave right now, which is incredibly dangerous. People lose their lives every year in situations like this. And you know, if you're lucky enough to have air conditioning, you might be a little bit better off. But there's a wrinkle there that you might want to look into, and it has to do with smart thermostats. So the Electric Reliability Council of Texas, ERCOT, the group that got a lot of bad press during last winter for all of what happened in Texas there, has urged residents to do their part by raising the temperature on their thermostats. But several smart thermostats owners say their devices have been controlled remotely to conserve energy, leaving them in sweltering homes without a clue as to why. So you set it to a certain temperature, but remotely the company can actually change it to a higher temperature, sometimes a substantially higher temperature. And the reason is that you might have signed up without reading the fine print into a program that gave them the right to do that. Several residents in the Houston area said they'd unknowingly enrolled in a program called Smart Savers Texas as part of a promotion. The agreement states that in exchange for an entry into a sweepstakes, electric customers grant permission for the program's creator, Energy Hub, to control their thermostats during periods of high energy demand. And during those times, they can increase the temperature on participating thermostats by up to 4 degrees to reduce energy consumption and relieve stress on the grid. So I am assuming, Yasmin, that you have not experienced anything like this, but you're in the Houston area, aren't you?
Yeah, I am. I'm in Houston. This is like, I'm laughing. It's not funny, but it's such a ridiculous thing to have happened. First of all, we are in a heat wave, I guess, you know, but 90 triple digit temperatures in June, July, August, September are not unusual for Texans, right? I heard that we had a heat wave. I didn't even notice it. I just thought, oh, it's June, it's summertime, you know? I heard on the news that I was in the middle of a heat wave, right? And then we started getting all these notifications on our phones that ERCOT wants us to start conserving energy. What were they saying? That we need to put our thermostats up to 82 during the nighttime. I don't know a single Texan who was on board with that. I don't know a single person who complied with any of that. And the thing is, we shouldn't have to, because consumer usage of the Texas power grid is not even its biggest sector, right? We're a smaller proportion of the total energy usage, right? If you need to cut the energy, cut it in all those empty office buildings that nobody's using anymore. Like, there's so many different options besides asking people in a heat wave to cut down to 82. Who can sleep in 82, honestly? Nobody. I'm always cold, and that's way too hot for me. And after what we saw in February, you know, the whole idea was, you know, oh, they're not used to the cold. This is unacceptable, because we are used to the heat. And this is right before hurricane season, and here in Houston, that is I'm not optimistic about what's going to happen this summer.
Yeah,
so that is kind of a year. Yeah.
82, like if it's 82, the system better not even be on. Like, it's being lowered to 82. That seems like an issue. And look, you're right. It might be that in some areas of Texas, it doesn't feel like the worst ever. But there are, like, in multiple cities, in Palm Springs and a number of other cities, records are actually being set right now for this time of the year. So that's bad. And 4 degrees, like when you say 4 degrees, it's like, oh, it's 4 degrees. That can be a significant difference. And bear in mind, some of these people are elderly. Like, people die because of these extremes in temperature. And I'm not saying that this program is necessarily going to kill people. But what I am saying is that the issues that Texas is experiencing, the issues that their energy grid are experiencing, this is not the fundamental solution to it. So they might say, look, we really need to do this, because if we don't do this, then the energy grid is going to go down, and 82 is going to look like, you know, an Arctic vacation at that point. Maybe, but then actually do something about it. Use your power as an industry to get Texas politicians to do something, but they have such a cushy relationship, they don't actually want that. It's much easier to just put it onto the individual people when some sort of systemic solution to their energy grid is obviously what's needed. Especially when all this abuse is to be entered into a sweepstakes, where like one person gets something or you get credited. Like in this one case in Philadelphia, you got $120 bill credit that they lowered to $40 afterward. $40 to potentially suffer multiple times per year during the worst heat waves. That doesn't seem like a great deal.
No, and something that I should point out is that these ERCOT board members do not live in Texas. So all these people are demanding that Texans do all these things, and they're not doing it themselves. They don't have to, they don't live here. And it's, you know, you see similar issues in different sectors of, you know, different issues around the country right now. So if you take the oil and gas industry, for example, you know, I have to stop using plastic straws, but they're gonna keep producing them. They're gonna keep wrapping all these produce and unnecessary plastics and things like that. But I, as a consumer, I need to stop using straws, right?
Yeah.
So that's not the case, or that shouldn't be the case. That's not going to ever be the solution, especially when you're combating these much, much, much bigger forces with a ton of money and a ton of donors and a ton of people who are profiting off of, you know, asking Texans to sleep in 82 degree heat.
Yeah.
And it is very unhealthy. And I only live in Houston because I have AC, right? If I didn't have this here, it's just a swamp. We live in a swamp. Actually, exactly. We went to a wedding over the weekend and it was up on the north side of Houston. And this one guy wasn't staying in the Airbnb with us. He had a hotel nearby. And after the wedding, everyone was not in great shape after the wedding, as you can imagine. And he texted the guys and he was like, hey, does your Airbnb have power? We're like, what? Yeah, we have power. His hotel just didn't have power. So he just drove home that night. Yeah, and so it's just weird. Like things like that keep happening. I don't know if that's related to ERCOT, but we were just like, no, I don't know why you don't have power right now. And the hotel people had no excuses. So it's not practical. You can't stay in a place without air conditioning.
I agree. Yeah, and I didn't know that about the ERCOT, that they generally don't live in Texas. But wherever they are, I guarantee it ain't 82 degrees when they're sleeping. I feel confident in that.
Absolutely not.
Now, the bashing of Texas continues, though. We bring Yasmin on so that I can own Texas. Anyway, we're gonna continue with one of, I believe this is Yasmin's favorite politician. So let's turn to this.
Oh no.
Ted Cruz is a weenie. I don't need to convince you of that, I'm sure, but I do wanna give you further evidence. And it has to do with critical race theory and his defense of the offense against critical race theory, which is completely fact free. He said in response to Charlie Sykes talking about the push to ban critical race theory across the country in places where it's not being taught, Ted Cruz responded saying, Trump derangement syndrome is astonishing. Sykes, who used to be conservative, is now defending critical race theory. He proffers a series of straw men, e.g., don't ban it. Nobody is banning it, but we don't have to allow schools to teach our kids to hate each other based on race. Now, I was actually super happy to hear that nobody was banning it, because I had been fooled by the lamestream media into thinking that many states were actually in the process of banning it. And many Republicans were calling for that. I guess it's not true. I guess that Ron DeSantis, when he gave a speech so proud of himself for banning it in Florida, I guess he was lying to us. All the youth activists that are fighting back against it in Florida, I guess they're wasting their time. I guess Texas didn't ban it, which is great for our guest Yasmin, who lives there. I guess there's nothing to worry about, because nobody is banning it. But once I got over my like surprise and happiness, I did look it up and it turned out, oh wait, no, he's just lying. As of last week, 21 states across the country are in the process, or already have, five, have already banned the teaching of critical race theory in classrooms. And Ted Cruz, of course, Yasmin, knows that. And just like a little weenie, because he doesn't want to engage with the disconnect between trying to ban a philosophical concept or lens on history from schools with then saying that cancel culture is the worst thing in America. So instead, he just lies about it. What are your thoughts?
What are my thoughts on Ted Cruz? My best friend Ted Cruz. Yeah, so he's lying. A lot of really, really scary things have been happening in Texas lately, which a lot of the country has been noticing and paying attention to and covering, which is a good thing because it's all ridiculous. And sometimes here in Texas, I forget that, you know, our state issues are national issues. And I'm glad that they are national issues because it needs to be talked about. The problem with people who oppose critical race theory is just like, why? You know, they don't have a good reason apart from their own racism or their own white privilege. And they can't acknowledge that by any means, right? They definitely can't acknowledge it because white privilege isn't a real thing, as we all know, according to these people. But it does hurt people, right? I remember growing up when in elementary school, I grew up in Connecticut, so I wasn't in Texas in elementary school, but growing up, you would be taught things in school. And even as a child, your brain's like, oh, that doesn't really make sense. Or, oh, that's kind of, that seems kind of weird. You know, simple things like they tell you
algebra.
Christopher Columbus was the first, yeah, algebra. Yeah, but you know, like Christopher Columbus was the first person to come to America. He discovered America, but also the Vikings were here before, but they don't count. Also the Spaniards were here before, but they don't count. There's all these things that kids are taught in school that are very, very highly debatable. And I'm 32 years old. If I ever want to have kids, that is a really concerning thing for me, is what are these kids being taught in schools, especially in Texas? Yeah. I mean, we're trying to bring back cursive writing instead of critical race theory in Texas. I don't know if they actually did, but they decided that that's something that needs time in the 180 days that kids get in school every year. Like, we need to definitely dedicate some of that time to this. Yeah. And it's also backwards, and it all is just deflection from the actual issues.
I agree. Yeah. It's not what they think it is. It's not what they say it is. It is convenient to try, like, they know there's a lot of people out there that have pretty bad views on race. And they don't want to feel bad about that. And they don't want to be made to feel bad about that. Someone has to speak up for and defend these people, and they have provided a defense. Anything that makes you think a thought that hurts a little bit in your brain, that's critical race theory, and it can be rejected. You don't need to engage in it. And I don't mean that, like, you don't have to willingly engage in it. You will not have to engage in it, because we're going to ban it. Regardless of whatever possum face losers like Ted Cruz have to say about it, it's a ban when you ban something. I know that that's complicated. I wanted to make sure, rigorous research. I looked it up. The definition of ban is to prohibit, forbid, or bar, which they've done. And what I love is the dictionary example of banning is a dictator getting rid of things critical of his regime. Isn't that funny? But anyway, yes, when you make it so that kids can't learn something and that teachers could potentially suffer legal consequences for teaching it, that is very much banning, and you can expect a lot more of it. I'm not gonna read this whole Trump thing, but Trump literally called for a ban, in those words, of taxpayer dollars going to any school system that teaches critical race theory. And he encourages people to pass those in states around the country, and eventually encourages the Republicans to do it at the national level. Not using euphemisms, he literally says to ban it. So that is what is going on. Now, that said, I want to see how much more damage I can do to Yasmin's brain and mental state. So I'm gonna make her listen to this next video in just a second. Republicans recently have been trying to thrust critical race theory, or their weird version of it, into literally everything. Sometimes in a way that's not quite artful. Like, it still takes a little bit of thought to try to make everything about critical race theory. So I want you to listen to this. It's Fox and Friends, which is like one of the most watched news shows in the entire country. This is Ainsley Earhart trying to talk about immigration with critical race theory and gas taxes and everything else. I assume because her teleprompter broke, but here is what she had to say.
Telling you, the midterms are going to be interesting because people are not in favor of this. We all have a heart for many of them. If you're an asylum seeker and you're persecuted in your country, you're legally allowed to be here and you can come over.
You can apply.
Even if you can apply, right. And then they investigate and they determine that. But just to walk over and to not follow the rules and do what everyone else has done, we're seeing gas prices going up. We're seeing people, the majority of America, even the Democrats, say they want you to have to show an ID when you go and vote. Democrats that are on the Hill right now, they don't want that. It's gonna be interesting because, and then critical race theory in our schools, we've gone so far to the left on this. Kamala Harris won't go down there to the border. Now she's passing this, she's in charge of this child tax credit plan where parents under a certain amount of money will get $3,600 a child. And so are people gonna have more kids just so they can get more money? Are these illegal immigrants who might come over and are on the books and do pay taxes, are they gonna get this credit too? Are all their children gonna get this credit? These are all the questions and all the concerns of Americans. Did I mention high gas prices?
You did. That's,
my dad's upset about that. And inflation.
Yeah, no, you mentioned it. You mentioned pretty much everything randomly, like just like a fire hose of talking points. I don't know. Something with people coming across the border and then gas prices. I guess immigrants are messing with the gas prices. I don't know, but you should be worried about it. Why critical race theory? Also stuff, and Harris, doesn't she suck? I don't know, but I guess millions of people are watching that and finding it to be very convincing, Yasmin.
I forgot what her original talking point was, so I had to look back at the Chyron for the damage.
It's about migrants.
Yeah, and I was just I forgot what her original point was as I was watching that clip. It feels like a lot of fear mongering. It feels like taking an advantage of an audience that you understand is very poorly informed about a lot of these issues. So you can kind of throw a whole bunch of terms that they have already been told are scary terms at them. So they all just conflate it together. Like, oh, immigration is bad, so is critical race theory. And if we didn't have immigrants, maybe we wouldn't need critical race theory. Like, I don't know what her point was. I don't know how she was trying to tie it all in together. I don't know why gas prices are involved. I don't know why Kamala Harris is involved. But here we are. And you know, it is concerning because that is one of the most watched news programs on the news today. And Fox News really does have a monopoly on their narrative, right? You know, they don't have a whole, you know, there isn't a CNN and an MSNBC equivalent to Fox News, right? So whatever they say, people just hear that and then they go with it. And then, you know, the narrative is important, right? Because you could have somebody who looks like the woman who was talking just now say all these terms to someone like me very confidently. And I know what it is. She knows what it is. But the people parroting her back, they don't understand what they're saying, right? Yeah. And all these ideas keep getting perpetuated. You know, that's why people can say with all the confidence in the world that the Civil War was fought over states' rights and not slavery, even though obviously it was fought over slavery. It's there in their bylaws, you know? So it is a problem. It doesn't make any sense, but it's a problem. And I think it is hard for people like you, John, who your head will explode just trying to make sense of it and having to communicate that to people, you know? And we all appreciate the work that you do because it is hard and it is infuriating and it will make your head explode.
It will. I would like people to not just throw talking points at you.
Yeah.
Like if you can't explain why critical race theory is wrong in a way that actually reflects in any way on what it is, then that's an issue. That's an issue.
Yeah, and especially it hasn't been done.
Exactly.
In any of their arguments, they haven't said why it's bad or why it doesn't need to be taught in schools. They haven't offered any kind of actual explanation as to why they're so against it, because the actual reason they can't say out loud.
Exactly. They just don't want you to talk about racism because they want their voters to feel comfortable feeling racist.
Yeah.
Anyway, and it can go to extreme lengths. We're going to save the video I was going to play for tomorrow because there's one more story I want to make sure that we get to, and we only have about 6 minutes left. So let's jump into this last one. Undercover video from an employee at an Amazon facility, apparently in Scotland, shows that millions of unsold products get destroyed, including incredibly valuable products as well. Let's show you a little bit of this video that one of the workers gave to ITV in Britain.
Secret footage captured in what's known as the destruction zone, and that calls into question the company's environmental and ethical practices. An ITV News investigation reveals unsold laptops scanned not for delivery, but instead marked destroyed. Boxes full of electrical items, such as drills, shavers, headphones, even smart TVs. The list goes on. Brand new books still in their wrappers, or jewelry or steel cutlery with that same instruction, destroy.
And look, I think even if that was just a little bit of that, that would be pretty insane. But apparently, there's a weekly target at that one facility of 130,000 items to destroy. And apparently, so there's different ways you can get rid of these things. You can destroy it or you can give it away. I think many of you watching that are probably thinking, wait, can't you just give that to people? Like random people, or I don't know, maybe just the employees who you're abusing. Well, they do give away a little bit. In comparison to the 124,000 items marked destroy, 28,000 were marked donate. So isn't that nice? A tiny little percentage of it. And you know, it's some stuff, it's like, you know, cheap jewelry or whatever, but it's MacBooks and it's fans and iPads and TVs. And this whole thing just seems insane, Yasmin. I don't understand what system could produce the need for this much destruction and waste.
It's like the ERCOT thing that we were talking about earlier, how, you know, I'm being expected to recycle and conserve as much as possible, but you have people like Amazon, well, I guess not people, but you have companies like Amazon who are just being so wasteful and they're seeing no consequences of it. And there's a reason why Jeff Bezos is going to space and there's a petition to leave him there, you know, because he's doing so much harm to this country, so much harm that so many people around the entire globe are trying to combat. But how can you possibly compete with it? It's so wasteful. Any kind of waste kind of hurts my heart. I don't like it. I don't know if that's because I was just the way I was raised or whatever the case is, but any kind of waste is waste. You know, it doesn't need to happen and it's so pointless. And I am curious as to what determines whether something is destroyed or donated. Like what is the criteria there? And why is one so much more than the other and not the other way
around? I don't know. I am hoping that if enough people talk about this story, that maybe they will shed a little bit of light on that. Preferably maybe change the situation a little bit, but it's pretty bad. Like 6 million products at that facility. A previous report in France found 3 million products being destroyed. That's France and Scotland. I will just assume that nothing like this happens in the United States. But if it does, that could be really bad. And so this is just one of a number of different issues that thankfully employees at Amazon have made people aware of. This is a massive corporation. There are some benefits to that, but there are clearly a lot of negatives, both in terms of the ethical implications of wrecking TVs and stuff rather than giving them away, but also the environmental stuff. 6 million products for one facility, that's a lot of waste that's being produced. Maybe there could be practices that would make it not actually have to happen at all. But anyway, maybe at some point we'll learn more. Thank you to all the reporters that are talking with employees and getting us this information. Unfortunately, we are down to almost no time and I want to make sure that we thank Yasmin, great job. Great to have you on as always. And I want to let people know where they can see more of your work.
You can find me on Instagram. That's the easiest way to find me. My Instagram handle is YazK with 5 Z's in the middle. So YAZZZZZK. I know I always do that funny. People always make fun of the order that I do that in. But yeah, 5 Z's, YAZZZZZK.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much.
And then Twitter, YazzyK. Yeah. Thank you for having me. Always a pleasure.
Always glad to have you on. Have a good day. And for those of you at home, thank you so much for watching. I'm going to be speaking in just a little bit with Dave Leventhal. So you can expect that coming up soon. Also, our top 10 list for the week, the top 10 objective definitive list of animals is now up on the YouTube channel for our tier 2 and tier 3 members. So if you're one of those, you can enjoy that and leave an idea for future top 10 there. We have the results of the poll. Where are the results of the poll? I don't see them, but let's bring them up. So we asked you if any voting rights bill will eventually pass, and damn, it's a pessimistic audience. 90.65% say no. Less than 10% are like, maybe something. And we're not saying for the People Act. We're not saying the John Lewis Act. We're saying literally any bill. And apparently you don't think it's likely to happen. I still have hope that something will happen. I don't know what will be left in that thing by the time it gets through there, if anything, but we will find out. In any event, thank you for watching everybody. Tomorrow's Big News Wednesday with Jared Jackson. So until then, stay safe out there, stay sane out there. We'll see you soon. Last year, the questionable stock market actions of former senators, Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue led to at least a bit of national conversation about whether it makes sense for elected politicians to be able to own and trade individual stocks. But as of now, nothing has actually been done to stop that. That said, some politicians are working on a potential fix of the solution. And joining us now to discuss, Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for Insider, Dave Leventhal.
Hey, John, how are you?
I'm doing well. It's great to have you back on, particularly about this topic, because you've got a recent report on Insider about Representative Pramila Jayapal and her recent effort to do something about this stock situation. So what is she planning?
Well, she, along with Senator Elizabeth Warren, both have proposed dueling pieces of legislation that would effectively say no more. If you're a member of the House, if you're a member of the Senate, and you want to buy and sell individual stocks, individual stock shares, you would be prohibited from doing so going forward. So this has been something that has been tried many times over the past many years, most notably about a decade ago when the Stock Act, a bill that touched on stocks but ultimately was watered down to a great degree, tried to prohibit it, failed. And there have been individual bills that Elizabeth Warren has put forward to try to do the same thing, also have failed. What's different this time around, of course, is that the Democrats control both the House and the Senate. Elizabeth Warren, for her part, sits on the Senate Finance Committee. So at the minimum, there's a chance that this is going to go forward in a way that it hasn't, even just as recently as last year, John.
Okay, well that's good to hear. Now, as you pointed out, they're dueling bills. So she's Elizabeth Warren is moving forward in the Senate, Representative Jayapal in the House. What are the major differences between the two bills?
Well, they haven't been introduced yet, so we don't have the actual text, but you can pretty much rest assured that they're going to be almost identical, if not flat out identical, and that they would be on parallel tracks, almost in a similar way to what we're discussing right now with HR 1 and Senate Bill 1, the big overarching omnibus ethics and voting rights and campaign money bills that are being debated in the Senate in earnest right now and has been passed in the House. So look for it to also go kind of on that parallel track in a way that might not be quite as high profile as what we're dealing with HR 1 and Senate Bill 1, but something too that has really kind of created its own heat, in part because of the members of Congress that you mentioned who've run into trouble with stocks, and also some recent examples. Democrat Tom Malinowski, for example, we've done a lot of reporting on him about how he failed for 2 years, for example, to report any of his stock trades, which is actually in violation, or would appear to be in violation, of that Stock Act that, although watered down, still mandates that members of Congress must publicly disclose any stock trades that they make, even if they still can go ahead and do them.
Yeah, you know, you were referencing to the trouble last year with Loeffler and Perdue and a few others as well. They didn't get any legal trouble or ethics trouble, like formal ethics trouble, ethically, whether it's a problem is a different consideration. But I'm curious, coming out of that, do we know anything about what regular voters think about this? Like, my perception is that it seems to have hurt those two in their reelection bids. But do we have any actual data about whether voters want this practice to be banned?
Anecdotally, I can tell you, I've talked to a lot of voters, both Democrats and Republicans, who say, wait, this is legal? This can happen? You have to explain. Yes, in fact, this is legal. And they wonder why. And then you go through all the legal aspects of it and legislation that has not been passed that would have addressed this. I think what really gets them in particular is the notion that you have lawmakers who are investing in companies, and it might be ExxonMobil, it might be Facebook, any of the companies that oftentimes will come before Congress to testify before congressional committees, that in many cases spend millions of dollars lobbying the federal government. And also in many cases too, are working with the government and jockeying to try to win government contracts. There's a huge financial incentive for these companies to be working with or even fighting with government. Yet at the same time, the lawmakers, who are the ones who obviously are in charge of not only passing laws, but hearing all these companies out, have a personal financial interest in many of these cases in those very companies. And that publicly, or at least among members of the public, seems to rub them considerably the wrong way. I haven't seen any good polling on this, but if you're a pollster and you're listening right now, that might be a good thing to ask people as to at this moment in time, whether the needle has moved in favor of doing away with the ability for lawmakers to buy and sell individual stocks.
I would love to see that. I'm also curious what other politicians think. You know, in your piece about this, that Representative Rokana spoke out in favor of the bill. I know that Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez last year did multiple times. Yep. Have you had any indication, whether you can name them or not, about whether other politicians are in favor of this or not? I mean, it is obviously going to limit their ability to monetize their influence, so I would suspect some might have a problem with it, but what does it look like so far?
Sure. Well, on one end, I've talked to some lawmakers. Sometimes they don't want to attach their names to this, but who will make the case to say, look, you know, we We don't want to limit, even though we're public officials, limit what we can do in our personal lives. Yes, we are representing the body politic. Yes, we are representing our districts or people in our state. But at the same time too, we should have the right to invest our money as we see fit. But yes, you have on the other side the argument with some lawmakers saying it should be banned. And the ones that you named, I would add Mark Pocan from Wisconsin to that list, and a few others who are very much, Ilhan Omar from Minnesota, who very much oppose this and think that lawmakers just simply because of their position and because of the interactions, and also to the kind of not insider information by definition, but access to information that you or I or most members of the public would not be privy to, that they should not be trading stocks as a result of that. And I should also note too, John, that there are some lawmakers that simply as it is right now, just opt out. They only invest in mutual funds or broadly traded funds. They're not going in and day trading. They don't have individual stocks. So there's that element to it. And finally, back to the other side, there are a couple of representatives who said, look, I want to trade individual stocks or have the right to do so, but I've either put my money in a blind trust. John Ossoff from Georgia, senator, has done this. Or they have a financial advisor who it's kind of unclear as to how much control the individual member of Congress has over that financial advisor. But they say, hey, my financial advisor, they're the ones who are making all the decisions, not me.
Sure. That is a convenient excuse. And let's dive into a few examples of that. I'm speaking with the Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for Insider, Dave Leventhal. And we've been talking about some of your reporting on stock trading by representatives. And I know that in your recent work, you've been looking into a number of, in some cases, tens of millions of dollars of trades being made. It seems like much of this, if some of the bills to limit individual stock ownership wouldn't be possible. But I want to focus on one in particular. And that is that you have found what would seem to be a bit of a financial to ideological inconsistency with Representative Marjorie Greene's recent trades. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but what have you found in your investigation of her financial activity?
Well, we looked into some recent stock trades that she has made, and she has made some trades that would absolutely seem to conflict, at least at their face, with her public philosophical leanings when it comes to politics. So for example, she recently last month invested up to $15,000 in Walmart. Well, what's notable about that? Walmart embraced the Black Lives Matter movement. Marjorie Taylor Greene has called the Black Lives Matter movement tantamount to terrorism. So the fact that she's investing in a company that has publicly said that they are absolutely 100% behind Black Lives Matter, believe in social justice and equity, is a curious thing to say the least. Also too, she's invested in NextEra Energy, again, spending up to about $15,000. Members only put them in, put these prices in broad ranges by law. And NextEra Energy is notable too because of the big power companies out there operating in the United States. They've been sort of at the vanguard, the forefront of trying to switch from dirty energy to clean energy and get down that road as fast as possible. Marjorie Taylor Greene has been a major climate change skeptic and has been very public about a number of different things involving global warming and climate change. So just two examples, and I would add a third, is that she invested in a bunch of tech stocks previously and then sold them back in January at a time when she was casting great dispersion against Facebook and Twitter and various other big tech social media companies that she felt were squelching the voices and censoring the voices of conservatives such as herself.
Exactly, possibly making quite a bit of money off of that squelching. You say that she, we don't know exactly how much was sold, that's not how it works, but potentially up to a couple of $100,000 of Facebook, Google, Apple, and Amazon. You know, all companies that not just she, but many conservatives have taken to attacking recently. So that would seem to be inconsistent, making money off of these companies in the areas of, you know, their apparent support for terrorism or their acknowledgement of climate change, them being tech ones. I don't know if she's like investing in documentaries about critical race theory or something. I'm not sure what else is needed to complete the circle, but what does she say about all of this?
Well, I emailed her office. She emailed me back, and we talked about this a moment ago. And she gave the, some might call it an excuse. Others would say this is perfectly fair and legitimate. But what she said just straight up was that She has a financial advisor, and her financial advisor, not her personally, made these trades. I asked some other questions about the nature of her relationship with the financial advisor, whether she has any control over individual stocks that are off limits to trade for the financial advisor, given that person guidance. She didn't get back to me on those particular questions, but it really does speak to the underlying issue that the rules, the regulations that govern this type of activity are very loose. The lawmakers have a great deal of latitude in how they can operate when it comes to investing their personal money, even if there are conflicts, real or perceived, with the companies that they are investing their money in.
And you know, for people who may not have a financial advisor, like having a financial, that doesn't necessarily, I mean, that could mean many different things, but she, that doesn't preclude that she could be giving orders to purchase or sell individual stocks. Just having a financial advisor doesn't stop that, correct?
No, not at all. And so if you have a financial advisor, it could be a very nice fig leaf, for example, to say, oh, well, you know, my financial advisor is doing all this stuff, all these trades. I have a very arm length relationship. The only way that you can kind of codify that, if you will, or put it into writing is to create a blind trust where you actually have a written, signed, sealed, delivered agreement that is approved by the Congressional Ethics Committee that says effectively, I have given complete control of my assets to a third party. I have this kind of relationship with them or not. It details it in black and white and the public can see it. So that is something that is much more formalized than just simply saying I got a financial advisor, which is pretty much a half measure between that blind trust and just laissez-faire, all no holds barred. I'm gonna day trade as a member of Congress, which happens too.
It does. Finally, any word from the office of Representative Green about whether she'll be supporting Representative Jayapal's bill?
No, asked that question as well, and have not received an answer. I think it's a safe bet, stock or otherwise, to presume that she will not be supporting that bill. At least no indication that she will at this point in time.
I think you're probably gonna end up being right there, Dave. As always, Dave Leventhal, thank you so much for your work. You've been incredibly prolific recently, and it's very important that people know in this area where our representatives might be profiting. So I appreciate your work.
Thank you, John.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.